Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. You can now access most of my coaching and guidance through my Thrive Sober online video course. This is an easy to follow course containing 50 videos with backed up writing and recommendations that can be worked through in your own time. There is a brilliant app that you can download to access the course on your phone or your tablet. You can skip through the course choosing content you most need in that moment, or you can work through them from 1 to 50 in order. You can come back to the learning or redo sections to help with parts of emotional sobriety that you are struggling with. The course covers holidays, summertime, Christmas, socializing, what to read, identifying and coping with triggers, complacency, the 100-day moderation trap, breaking down old beliefs, managing your thoughts, sugar cravings, and plenty more. You will also get a free copy of my Thrive Sober ebook in the introduction section. Visit www.thrivesobercoaching.com/course to learn more or get access. Use coupon code HALFPRICE to get 50% off. I've had so many messages from people that say the ebook and the course together has been the thing to get them over the line and achieving their first 100 days successfully sober. Hello and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today I'm talking to Hannah, who is originally from Leicester, just like me, but now she lives in very glamorous Melbourne, Australia, which is not like me, but it's lovely to see you. In the backdrop, you've got this gorgeous skyline. It's dark, all the buildings are lit up. So I'm really super excited to get into your story today. And Hannah's actually sober today, 268 days. So amazing. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I was just saying before how this was the game for me. So it's nice to be here and be able to share my story with other people, like the other stories have helped me.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love how we were talking, weren't we? Because you had messaged me early on in your sobriety and said, I really want to come on your show. So it's a pleasure to have people coming on that, especially that are really listening and have found that the podcast helps them. So
yeah, it's so good.
Yeah, it's
so
probably good. Surreal for
it's
you.
It's a little bit of an honor. Bit of an honor, like, to be able to share my story, and hopefully people will find something in it that resonates and helps.
I'm sure they will. We were talking as well, weren't we, about how sometimes I do get what I would say are probably more high profile people wanting to come on the show that have written books and just, you know, do fabulous things. And I always have to politely decline and say, no, you're not every day enough. which is great. People say, oh, okay. All right. Thanks. But I love that it's just everyday normal stories, this show. And I think that's the thing that people find great comfort and great help from. So,
yeah,
it's lovely that you get to be part of that. And yeah, part of the sort of
legacy. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So why don't we get to know you a little bit? Tell us a bit about what you do, you know, for work and spare time and all that stuff.
Yep. All right. So obviously I'm Hannah. I am 35. I've got 4 kids. I'm happily, very, very happily married. I've been with my husband since I was 16. So we've really grown together and this has been a journey. Like you said, I was born in Leicester, but then we moved to Queensland and I was there for about 15 years. And I've only been in Melbourne for the last 3-4 months, which was quite a big move actually. Sobriety wise, which I'll go into with my story. We've got 3 businesses, which is one of the reasons we moved down here. And I've recently taken up ice skating since moving here. Yeah, I really love it.
Different.
Love that.
No, there's a rink like across the road and it's so close. We take the kids like, and then some evenings just me and the hubby will go over when the kids are in bed. It's fun.
Oh my God, that is so cool. That is definitely...
I'm not very good at it, but I'm getting there.
Yeah, that's definitely the coolest hobby I think I've ever had anyone.
So random. Like never in a million years would I have said, yeah, I skate.
Yeah, brilliant. Amazing. So, and what are your businesses? So four kids, three businesses.
Yeah.
I'm like a busy woman.
Yeah, life's busy. So we've got two e-commerce businesses, and then most recently we've opened up a logistics company as well, which support the e-commerce side.
Wow.
We've been in that world for like 13 odd years, so
yeah,
it's nothing new.
Yeah. Amazing. Hats off to you. Sound like a busy person. And you have time to skate. Love it. Which I'm sure the sober journey really supports.
Yeah, now I don't drink. I have way more time.
Exactly. More time. So, okay, well, why don't we go back to the start? Why don't you tell us about your life with alcohol and what that looked like?
Yep. Okay. I found this. I've already been thinking about this and I've loved the process of thinking about it because it's not something I thought about really until this. So obviously growing up in the UK, I feel like everyone was the same. We did, you know, drinking. I probably first drank when I was maybe 13 or 14, but I don't remember my first drink. I don't remember it being spectacular or anything special. I wasn't hooked on it straight away. But I was then, so 13, 14, it'd be like, you know, Alka-Pops at Christmas and that sort of thing, but which then turned into drinking on the park with friends. Stealing liquor out of mum and dad's cupboard. They don't listen to this. And the aim was then as well to get drunk. Like we used to, I don't know, spin around when we were drinking, thinking it would make us more drunk.
Yeah.
And then somehow I would go home and like mum wouldn't even have a clue. I must have stank, I don't know. But she didn't really know that I was drunk when I got home. I was obviously really good at not portraying it. And then I was out clubbing at the age of 15 in town. We used to go to bars and clubs. And again, never an issue. I didn't see it as a problem. Like, obviously, I was underage drinking, but it didn't cause me any issues. I met my husband when I was 16, and we used to go out together, and we had a good time. A lot of it was social drinking. Like we didn't drink at home. I wasn't sat at home drinking wine or anything. It was all with family and friends. And then I had my first son when I was 19. And then drinking slowed down then. Like I didn't fall into mummy wine culture then. It was still just drinking, you know, if we went around to the families for a roast dinner, we'd have some wine. And here and there, we'd, you know, go a bit overboard, but it really was not an issue. We moved to Australia then when he was one. So I was 20 when we moved here. And to be honest, it was too expensive to really drink much. Like coming from the UK, where it was so cheap, and coming here to Australia, it was so expensive. So we ended up just finding the cheapest beer we could, or we would drink the boxed wine, Goon, they call it here. And then when we were here, so we were pretty isolated, I think, at that point, moving here. We were both only 20. We had a one-year-old. So we did tend to drink at home then. And it was drinking the Goon and we'd, you know, go through a box. But again, still not an issue. Like it didn't cause me problems. It wasn't causing me mental issues. I didn't have anxiety the next day. It just was what it was. And then we'd get on with it and do it again. And we had fun. So that was our lives. Like we did drink alcohol for fun. So it was very much associated with it in my younger years. I think we drank also for boredom.
Mm.
Like, so we didn't get bored because we didn't have family here. And they eventually moved over actually. So mother-in-law and brother-in-law and sister-in-law, they all followed over. And so then the social drinking resumed and everyone being from England, when we get together, you know, sometimes we could polish off like six bowls of wine in a night. Yeah. But again, still like it, I never questioned it. It's just what we did.
Yes.
And it wasn't until, so I had two more kids, another girl and a boy. And again, we'd just drink at home if we were bored, or I don't think I really drank for stress. Never really got into the mummy wine culture that everybody talks about. I don't think that was ever a thing for me. But then in 2019, I got diagnosed with thyroid cancer. And it was around that time that I started to question everything. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was, you know, something so life-changing, life-altering that you start to go, what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
Or because I had my thyroid removed, and that's when I started to get the anxiety after I drank. I think I started to black out a lot more. I don't know if I was drinking harder. I'm not 100% sure. I just know that that was the turning point, is when all that sort of happened and I started to question it. And I read a book, and it was, I don't even remember why I read it. It must have been because I was questioning it, and I saw this book called A Happier Hour.
Yeah.
By an Australian lady called Beck Weller. And I read that, and then I was like, oh my God, that's me. So in that book, she would constantly be setting rules, you know, I'm going to go out tonight, I'm only going to have two drinks, and then waking up the next day and being like, oh my God, why did I do that? Why did I drink too much? And that's pretty much where I started to question it. And it took me from 2019 to 2023 to actually quit properly. So to get to this point, numerous day ones, which is why my Instagram account is called No More Day Ones. So yeah, I basically read that book, and I was in Canada for Christmas visiting my mum, and I was almost like reading it in secret. Like, I didn't want anyone to know that I was reading this book, because it was a bit like, oh my God, like, this is me. I think I've got a problem. And I managed to convince my husband and my sister and her husband to commit to 90 days alcohol free starting on the new year. And they were all up for it. I didn't tell them why. And I was like, awesome. You know, I've got some support. Like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do 90 days. And so we left Canada anyway. And me and my husband did the 90 days. And that was the longest I'd been alcohol free, like, for a long time. Because even pregnant, I'd probably have one or two here or there at social gatherings. So I don't think I'd done that long a period. And on day 91...
Just so that I've got the timing right here, because I know you mentioned it took 2019 to 2023, but when you read this book, this was 2019.
This was 2019, yeah. So the first time I took a big break.
Yeah.
Yeah.
2020, kind of new year.
First ever break, yeah. Yeah, so this would be, 2020.
Just before COVID, really, wasn't it? Just a few months before COVID.
It was, yes, because I was sober through COVID, pretty much through a lot of that. I didn't drink, and I was like, thank God, because that could have gone really downhill. Being at home, I mean, we didn't have it too bad in Queensland. I feel sorry for the rest of the world. We really did not have it bad, but still, I feel like, yeah, being home a lot, and it could have gone the other way. But yeah, like, not after 90 days, on day 91, I cracked open a bottle of Moët that had been taunting me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, as everyone does now, I can moderate. I'll just have a couple of glasses of this. And then, yeah, then there was just, for the next couple of years, was me just constantly beating myself up and trying to stop and then failing, and, you know, how it goes.
Yeah. Can I just ask, because this is really common, you know, this pattern. And can I just ask, what, after you did the 90 days and you went back to drinking, and then you said, you know, you had a couple of years of drinking and feeling really, really rubbish about that drinking, presumably also because you had done this stint, and you must have had some positive data from that 90 days. You must have had some, like, there must have been some days where you felt good, or, you know, there were bits of that. What was it that What do you think it was that was making it really difficult to make the jump again? Was it not having the goal? Was it facing the fact that you think you needed to do this maybe forever and that was just too hard to face? Like, what do you think it was that was making
that took that long? I don't think I fully committed at the 90 days. That was just my goal. Yeah. So that was it. That was the goal. And I don't think I fully committed. And yes, like forever was no, that was just too hard to handle, to think about, like too big a change. And I think when you first do it, you think, well, if I can take the 90 days, then I'm okay. I don't have a problem. Like I can stop.
Yeah.
But I think then after that, it's all the rule making and breaking and that really gets to you after a while, like continued failure, I suppose. That's what you feel like, is this continued failure.
Yeah. Because I can imagine it's kind of like, because I relate to this because I did 100 days myself in maybe 2000 and a couple of years before you did it. I did 100.
Yeah.
But I was very much 100 days goal orientated. That was it. And I did brilliantly for 100 days. I was going out, I was walking every day. I lost weight. I looked good. I got a new haircut. I mean, everything was just brilliant. But 101 days, I was back in. And I think I was back in then for another at least couple of years, I think. But I think that I was probably shocked how quickly I could fall back into drinking regularly again and how badly I was moderating, thinking the same as you, that maybe that 100 days would have fixed me and it didn't. And I think the reality of that is quite destabilizing because you think, well, what's wrong with me then? I've done this 100 days. I've shown myself that I could not drink. But yet here I am again, making all these mistakes or drinking when I don't really always want to, or drinking more than I want to, or just not managing to moderate as well as I thought I would. But then where else do you go from there? The only option, I suppose, really is quit for good. And because that's too difficult and too enormous a lot of the time for a lot of people at certain stages of this journey, you feel a bit between a rock and a hard place, I think. Feel a bit, it's almost quite trapped. That 100 days or that 90 days, it almost sets you up for that failure in a way, because I felt like my drinking even increased when I went back to drinking.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you definitely hit that button afterwards. And then you hit that button every time that you say you're going to stop again, because then you're like, well, tonight's my last night, so you know I'm going to down a bottle of wine and enjoy myself, I say with brackets.
Yeah.
And then the next day you're like, this is it, I've got it, and then you don't. And yeah, I think definitely not good for the old mental health, all of the setting the rules and trying and failing and just thinking, why can't I do this? But I didn't give up on giving up, and that's one thing I always say. So I'm a part of a lot of groups and things now, and I always say to people, just don't give up on giving up, like keep going. It's actually true what they say, like one day it will just, a switch will just flip. And I was chasing that for so long, and I questioned it so many times. I was like, people must be lying, like this is not working, it's not happening for me. And then one day it did. What was it? So 2023 was when I stopped on the 11th of November. And we were actually traveling Australia in the caravan. And we'd been to, I hadn't drank too much. I was drinking, but in the caravan, you know, it was hard not to. It was the done thing. In an evening, you'd have a beer or a wine. Or we tried not to do it too much because we were kind of living on the road. So we were like, okay, we'll have to try and control this so that we don't, you know, live in permanent holiday mode when we are actually just living life on the road. But we went to a Melbourne Cup event. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's a big, they call it the race that stops the nation. Melbourne has a public holiday for it, but we were up in Queensland and the whole of Australia basically does something for Melbourne Cup. So we went to this event up in Cairns and it was a free bar and they were showing the races. Everyone's dressed up. They had fashion on the fields and, but a free bar to someone like me. and it started at like 11 a.m. And so I didn't really eat. I drank a lot of wine. And I must have blacked out. And I've never had this before because I'm missing a bit of the day. And it was only me and my hubby. And the thing that pulled me out of this blackout, which has never happened, was he said to me, and not in a horrible way, this sounds awful, he said, I'm going to be picking you up off the floor in a minute. And that's because we'd been talking about that's what happens at the races. They have to pick all the girls up off the floor because everybody's wasted. And it was like I arrived back in my body. It was so weird. And I've never, ever had that where I've been in a blackout and then come back. And then so I stopped drinking, obviously, from that point. I was like, oh, my God, like that was the weirdest thing. And that the rest of that day, we went back to the van and I hated myself the most I've ever hated anyone. Like, it was horrendous. And I was like, this is it. I am so done. I can't do this anymore. But I didn't share that with anyone. Mm-hmm. And so a few days later, we traveled up the coast and caught up with some friends who we always drink with. And we went to a bar. And because I hadn't told anyone, I went to the bar and was like, oh, I'll just have a wine. I hadn't prepared. And so I ended up drinking again then, which this was the 11th. And it wasn't anything spectacular. We had dinner. We had a few bottles of wine. We all got a bit drunk. I went to the bottle shop, like the servo after, and got more wine because, I was always scared that we were going to run out. So I went and got a load more, went back. And then that night I actually put myself to bed, which never used to happen. I would always be the last one up. And then the next morning, I woke up so calm and I was like, that's it. Like, that is actually it now. I am done. And I was just had this calm feeling. I didn't have the anxiety or the hate or anything. And I was just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I deserve better.
Wow.
And that was it. Yeah. That was the switch.
It's incredible, isn't it? I love hearing these stories. I love it when people talk about what it was for them that in your words, flick the switch. But
yeah,
that calmness, that's so, when you reflect,
it's like a relief. Now, yeah. Yeah, you're just like relieved that I've made that. Like, that's it. I'm not going to put myself through that. Yeah.
Yeah. You've made the decision and you feel at peace with it. And that's so interesting, isn't it? Because it's, we talk about the cost of continuing to drink when it's costing that much, like it was for you, like yeah. It was for me, like it's probably for lots of people listening. The cost is too high, and the cost of actually just stopping is not as big as people think. Yeah, there's some initial outlay, cost, if you want to look at it like that. In that you have to navigate the social thing and friends and telling people.
Yeah, like it has forever. Its moments for sure. Like it's not, you don't just stop, feel calm, and then that's it. You've still got to do the work. There's still stuff involved. There's hard days. But, yeah, since I stopped, I haven't felt about myself the way I did when I was drinking, and that's best feeling.
So calm. And I think, I think that just that feeling of calm, even if, like you said, it's the calm before the storm of what's to come now that you've made the decision, it must have just been the right time. It was the right moment for you,
That's it, everything I think so.
Just felt aligned in that moment and you decided to act on it and you just went for it. And I can imagine that it must be for the body as well. It just must be a peaceful feeling of like, oh, right, okay, now let's get into gear more. We'll learn how to get to gear two, but at least we're in the car. At least we're in the car and the hands are on gear.
We're riding.
it's fascinating, and I feel like it makes me remember that feeling for myself, and it makes me appreciate it as well. Weirdly, I do feel like I'm so glad that I got to that place where I felt really bad and I felt really rubbish about myself and all those things, because I just might not be here doing this.
That's it. On this show, it happens for a reason, doesn't it?
It's weird to think to think that really, that had things not played out in my life in a certain way that they did, I just, maybe I wouldn't have got here. Hopefully I would have done, but would it have been, you know, 5 years ago? Or would it have been 3 years ago? I don't know. So yeah, so you woke up on that day, you felt this calmness, you just felt like you knew what you needed to do, essentially.
Yep.
What happened then? What did you do?
So obviously I'd tried and failed multiple times before. So I was like, something's got to change. I've got to do something different. So I made my Instagram page on that day and I called it No More Day Ones. And I only made it for me. Like, I was like, I'm not even going to make this public. Like, literally, I'm just going to post on here every day so that I can see the numbers going up. And I don't want to miss a day. I'm not going back to day one. That is it. So that was huge, actually, for me when I look back and I think, wow, that like was such a good thing to do, because it was, I just didn't want to let myself down. I wanted to see those numbers. So I did that. And then I, differently this time, I eventually opened it up to have followers. And I was like, okay, I think I've got to a point where I need community. And I never did that before. Like, the community is the best thing ever. Like, I'm on group chats now and I give advice to people, but I still have my moments, and there's people there always to champion me as well.
Yeah.
So that is just so nice. So community, I opened that page and we were still traveling. So my first 100 days, my day one, I was up in the Daintree rainforest up in Cairns, which was just the most beautiful place. And because I've got this Instagram page, I literally have a record of my life for the last 268 days, like every single day, something that I've done, thought, felt. Some days it might just be a picture of a cup of coffee, because coffee is life now.
Yeah.
But then other days I have moments where I write a lot more and go into things that have been happening. But I went back and had a look through the first 100 days, and we traveled. So we traveled down the Queensland coast. And then by the time because it was November, by the time we got home, it was Christmas. And Christmas for me was one of my biggest aims. And I had aimed for a sober Christmas for the last couple of years. And I was like, I was excited. I was like, this is it. I'm finally going to get the sober Christmas and I'm going to be present. And it was beautiful. My mum came from the UK and she also had stopped drinking for a little bit. Like, she had a couple of drinks here, but she's completely changed her relationship with alcohol as well. I'm super proud of her. So she wasn't really drinking. So it was really, really just the most beautiful Christmas. And that was the 100 days. And then after Christmas, we started preparing to move here to Melbourne, and it was super stressful. And so when I look back at those 100 days, I think, wow, I did so much. And I did it all without alcohol. And looking back, even just to do this, I was really proud, actually. Wow. to look back and think, I actually got through all of that. Like, it wasn't even just normal life. Yeah. None of it was normal life for me in those 100 days, but I got through it.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. It's like having like an online journal, essentially.
Yeah.
Which is such a great idea, especially because you can lock it down and make it very private.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was the same as you, but I didn't do mine until day 50. But to have it from day one, that's
it was a commitment. I was like, I'm not failing at this time.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I relate to that a lot, and that kind of that having that goal for yourself and it almost competing with yourself, like, I can do this. I can absolutely do it. And you only got to prove it to yourself. That I think that's a great motivator.
Yeah.
If you work in that way. And how about so in terms of your husband and relationship, and, you know, what was the impact of not drinking there? Or was that always something because you were trying to achieve it? It was just, you know, good for you.
So that was a big thing. So my marriage was actually always something I was looking for in your podcasts. I was scowling through before I got sober, trying to listen to people's experiences within their marriage, because it had been such a big part of our marriage. that I was like, well, what's going to happen? Like, how is this much of a change? Are we going to get through it? Like, we're a very strong couple. I'm so lucky to have such an amazing support. And even when I looked back at those 100 days, every couple of days it would be, I've had this wobble, but, you know, I had a hug with hubby, chatted it out, and it's all good. And he's always been there to reassure. He's honestly been my biggest rock. So I'm very lucky. I know there's a lot of people out there that don't have, you know, that support, or whose husbands are also big drinkers and kind of fight it. So I'm very fortunate that I don't have that. But I would say that one of the things that held me back for so long was my marriage and the change. I was scared. Yeah. I was scared of what it would do. I was scared that he wouldn't like me anymore because I might be boring. Mm. Like, what would we do? How would we fill our time? And it's in the complete opposite. So, like, we are so good together. He barely drinks anyway. He's a, you know, a unicorn. He can take it or leave it. Mm. But we've now found things. So we both ice skate together. And we're finding things and doing things that don't involve alcohol. And he's even finding more and more now that he's preferring to do things without alcohol as well, and that he's having more fun. So it's really nice.
Amazing. Yeah, yeah. You're right. It is a big concern for people, I think. How does sobriety land in a marriage or in a relationship where drinking has been a big part? You know, a lot of people get together and they're drinking from the get-go.
And we grew up together. So we, like, literally have lived the same life, you know, since being 16 to now. And so we've always kind of been the same. I always drank more, and I fully realized that I was the instigator in probably all of the drinking. I would always be the one that's like, let's have another glass. Open another bottle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like you say, then funnily enough, like, now he just doesn't drink that much anyway. Did you talk about it early on? You know, did you talk about your concerns and kind of fear?
I think we did, yeah. I remember because I did, fortunately, I'm really glad I did. Whilst I was trying to stop, I kept like an online kind of journal, and there's a few things in there where we'd had a chat, and I was like, we finally said, that's it, I'm going to quit. And, you know, obviously it was on and off.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did have a chat with him quite often. He knew, and he's done, you know, nothing but reassure me and really, really support me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so nice. That's great. I think it makes a big difference when you've got a big supporter, whether that's your partner or a friend in the family, or could be a stranger on the internet, you know?
Well, yes, like, I have found support there too. So
yeah, it can. It's just having somebody that's kind of there to prop you up a little bit when you're feeling wobbly, or just to give you that little chat of reassurance, or just to inspire you by showing you that there is a really positive way forward, and that there will be ups and downs, but that they won't last forever. I think that's what's so great about the sober community and about these kinds of podcasts and things like that. I just think that they just breed hope, and people need hope in the early bit of the journey. They just do. People need to feel
that
investment is going to be worth their while.
Yeah, because there was another thing I wanted to chat about, actually, because it was something that I hadn't come across really. Like, I expected I'd, you know, get sober and everything would be sunshine and roses. I knew there'd be obviously like some hard times or whatever, but I got to around 5 months, and it was around when we actually moved to Melbourne as well. So I don't know if it was also I moved to this big city where it's all underground bars and restaurants, and I was like, very, very triggered moving to the city. I was like, I don't know if I can do this and be here and be sober, because, you know, once upon a time, this, it would have been the life I wanted, being able to go to all these bars and restaurants and, you know, go out partying. But I got to like that 5 month mark, and I was suddenly finding it really hard again. And I like got angry about it. I got really angry and annoyed, and I was like, it shouldn't be this hard. Why is it so hard? I did later learn that there is a theme, that can happen where you do somebody, I was listening to another podcast and a lady called it the void, and kind of enter this void where something to do with your neurotransmitters kind of come in into balance, and you're on this big high to begin with, and then it kind of plateaus, and that can just feel a bit like, oh, like a bit, what is this? And so I went back to all of the tools that I used in day one, because I was like, okay, this has got hard again. I beat myself up for a little bit because I was mad that it was hard. But then my hubby, who I've often called my therapist, bless him, talked me around. He made me see sense. And he's like, you shouldn't be mad. You've not even drank. Like, why are you mad at yourself? Why are you mad? Because it's hard. It's going to be hard. We've moved city. Like, it's a big change. So yeah. I don't know if it was that like 5 month void or if it was the change, which has made me now prepared for if changes come again, I know that there may be something that crops up. But I literally went back to the tools that I used in day one. I started journaling again. I literally, all the podcasts, and I went back all into the work. And maybe like a month ago, so around 8 months, I put a lot of work in and I feel like I've come out the other side.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And I just wanted to make, I don't know, make that known that if anyone does find that like you will get through it, you just need to do the work again. And that's actually something that I'm doing now as well. It took me ages to figure out what the work is. I didn't know what I've been trying to find out, and I think I know what it is now, and I'm working on myself and it feels good.
Yeah, that's so good to hear. I was laughing then because I remembered thinking, what is this bloody work? I mean, yeah. Why can't I just find a book with instructions of what the work is?
Yeah,
you do have to figure it out. You do have to figure that out for yourself. And for me,
yeah, because it's different for everyone.
Hey. Yeah, exactly. For me, the work was very much around people pleasing and boundaries and learning to tune into what my real needs were and prioritize them.
Yeah.
And learning how to say no, and just all that stuff. And but it's different for everybody. I think that's such a great message that you've shared there. And I'm not even sure if this has even come up before on the podcast. So it's
no, really, I'm not sure if I've heard it, which is why it threw me, because I was like, what is this?
I mean, from experience and working with other people, this can happen for a number of different reasons. When you were talking, I was thinking it's probably a combination of what you think and feel.
The
move is going to be unsettling and, triggering for all the reasons that you mentioned. But I also think that people more often than not underestimate how much effort and how long it takes to get to that point where you feel really confident in the emotional sobriety. For me, it was about 12 to 18 months, if I'm being really honest. And I did my work every single day solidly throughout that time. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that what I see, and I'm not saying this is the same for you because it might not be, but what I see is that people go hard and fast at first. And they get a few months in and they're feeling good, and then they just take their eye off the ball a bit.
Yeah.
And what happens then is it leaves room for the two mates that you don't want to come on the bus, which is complacency and fading effect bias. And fading effect bias is essentially, to keep it really simple, it's got to do with memory production and formation. But it's when we look back, everything looks a little bit rosier than we seem to remember it. And that's to do with the fact that we form memories of the early part of our drinking evening. We lock them into the memory bank, and then the later memories, they don't get stored. So all the dark sides of the drinking, typically they don't always get stored, or they're quite fragmented, but all the good bits, like the feeling and the getting ready and the seeing friends and everybody clinking the glass and feeling amazing, that's what we tend to remember. And so when fading effect bias and complacency get on the bus, then, you know, that creates a lot of wobbliness in people, because if they're not doing the daily work, like daily reading, daily podcast, daily journaling, daily gratitude, and all the bits and bobs that they might have relied on very much in the early days, that complacency and fading effect bias can get out of control. And then before you know it, you're just thinking, what's the point? This is really hard, not feeling this, or this, but you know, whatever it is. And I've worked with people in my Thrive group, and they've been feeling that almost on month 10, month 11, and yeah. really worrying about hitting a year. And we talk about what you did instinctively, which was perfect, is you went back to the drawing board, you went back to sort of day one tools, and you know, that content going in and resetting those thoughts and just stopping all of those, you know, thoughts that aren't helpful and they're not supportive, stopping them from getting out of control and refocusing on why you're doing it and why it's, you know, good to do it, and all the positive messaging you get on those with that content, that can do so much, I think, for helping people shift out of these these different phases. And I also think as well that we are excellent at judging ourselves for having certain thoughts. So I remembered having a real pang of FOMO at 18 months. I was so cross at myself. How dare I, when I'm 18 months not drinking, something's wrong with me, you know, and all this stuff. And I was really annoyed at myself. I was really, really annoyed at myself. It really upset me that I got this far in. And then I suddenly thought, how long have you been drinking for, Terry? 27 years. How long have you been sober? 18 months. You just can't compare those two timelines. 18 months lost in a 27-year timeline. And it's not to say that however long you drink, you need that amount of time to undo it. But it just helped me have perspective on, actually, 18 months is amazing, but it is only 18 months, you know? I think that was the last time I really felt that proper wobble was 18 months. I never had it again. And I never felt anything, and I never feel anything now, you know, ever.
Yeah.
I miss drinking. But I think it taught me a lot about expectations and to not make things mean more than they really are. And that actually it's okay that sometimes these little wobbles might flare up, usually coincide with stressful moments or big change. And then
it's okay
to have to regroup and go back to the drawing board and just keep that content going in to really clear out that hard drive, because that's like what you're doing, isn't it?
I love that, of
drinking memories and drinking beliefs. But yeah, brilliant that you're in this much better place, and brilliant that you've raised it so that other people don't feel too alarmed if it happens to them.
And just stick with it. Really, do the work.
What was also really good there as well is that you set yourself up for next time, because that's what I always try to say to people. The trick is to never feel like never not feel triggered again. The trick is to expect the trigger to come. And, you know, if you don't have that, then that, you know, brilliant. But if you do, you're more prepared, because you're not in that energy of this shouldn't happen, because, well, why shouldn't it? You know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, I think that's really, really great messaging. So, what would you say has been the biggest gain for you in terms of not drinking?
So the biggest is probably not hating myself.
Yeah.
Because that was the worst part of it. And actually my relationships and my marriage.
Yeah.
I think everything around, also I'd say that's relationships in general, isn't it? It's just relationship with myself, with my husband, with my kids, like everything's just better.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah. It's nice.
Yeah, it is nice. Yeah, it is really nice. And what do you think in terms of the most difficult bit? Although obviously I know we just talked about that wobble, which has probably created, you know, been a big challenge for you. But what else, particularly in the first 100 days, what else do you remember that was quite challenging about not drinking?
I think it was probably social situations I probably struggled with the most, especially when you've built the persona of being the drinker and you're the one that will stay up. And like, we had friends who a couple of them questioned it when we were at parties, and I got a bit of the, oh, I wish kind of the party girl was here, or like, yeah, just some of that I found really hard. But I've learned now that's, you know, that's not me. It's not me. Like, it's obviously a reflection on that they're maybe a little bit uncomfortable with what I was doing. That's great now. It was only at the very beginning. But yeah, I think social, but now I don't need a drink to be social now.
Mm.
I actually prefer it. I prefer going out for dinner. I can go out to bars and stuff now, and they have awesome mocktails and things here. So I don't feel like left out. Not, I wouldn't anyway now, but yeah, I can go out and socialize comfortably now, and that doesn't bother me at all. I think now I've noticed that if I get stressed or emotional is when I would have a little ping of a thought of, oh, a drink would make this easier. And then I just obviously squash that down.
Yeah.
They know it wouldn't.
Yes. Yeah. And talking about that, that kind of more emotional toolbox, which lots of people, when they stop drinking, they realise is quite empty, you know, when it comes to managing big emotions or feelings or challenging situations. What do you do, or what have you learned about yourself, or what tools have you put in that box?
Well, I, for one, never ever thought that I drank for emotional reasons until I stopped drinking. And then that's when I realized that I did, because when they came up, I did not know what to do or how to deal with them. I've gone really big into meditation, breath work, mindfulness, affirmations. Like, they're so good. I literally stick them on in the car with the kids now. I'm like, listen to this. It's amazing. So yeah, I got really big into that and talking. So that support person, so for me, it's my husband. But talking anything through so that it doesn't, I overthink a lot. And I've learned that if I just get it out straight away, it doesn't become a thing.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, they've been really big for me. So talking about things like as soon as you can when they come up, if you've got someone. And then, yeah, meditation and, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great, isn't it? It's great. I think it's been a really nice part of the journey, is building, getting more strength in that toolbox from starting the journey and not feeling like I could go with hardly anything at all. And now feeling like I can, like I'm good at self-diagnosing now as well.
Yeah.
Like I'm getting better and better all the time at knowing what might be wrong or what I need. And I think that's
being self-aware. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you've got your own back now.
Yeah. Such a big one. I love that. Got your own back, self-validation, especially as an ex-people pleaser. that feels really good to know that I know deep down what's going to be right for me, what I'm good at, what I'm not great at, and all of those things are okay. You know, it's fine. It's okay not to be good at everything, and it's okay to not want to socialize the way that I did when I was a drinker, and to sort of adjust to that, because I think a lot of people do worry about that, don't they, about how everything, the landscape, the social landscape, how that all transforms, and friendships and like that. But
you do worry about what people are going to think. Like, I've actually got a thing coming up this weekend, and it's with a whole bunch of new school mums who I went out with, and none of them know that I don't drink. And so the whole night I was kind of pretending I was drinking. None of them like got drunk, and I'm sure they wouldn't care, but still there's that little bit of, I don't really know these people. Are they going to accept me? And it's because when I drank, if I met new school mums or whatever and they drank, I would be like, you're my person. But if they didn't drink, I might have been like, and this is awful, I might have been like, they're not my person.
No,
So there's a bit of fear around that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they won't care, but I probably still won't tell them that I'm not drinking.
Yeah. No, I do get that. I often find myself as well sometimes thinking, There's lots of mums that are friends at my daughter's school, and they're all absolutely lovely. And I know that if I was drinking, I would just be in the thick of their nights when you see on social media that they've been out or they do lots of things together. And I think sometimes I sometimes think, oh, I have a bit of envy there, because they're obviously all connected and they look like they all have a really good time, and everyone gets on and all their kids get on, and I miss out on that. Like, I don't have that. But then I remind myself that that's what you choose, Terry. Like, you don't have that for a reason, and that's okay. And even
you've got to think about what you do have.
Yeah, exactly. But also I think that it's also, it is easy. I think social media, that is probably one of the downsides of social media, is when everyone else looks like they're having so much great fun. But actually, I am more introverted than I ever really realised that I ever was. And my husband's very similar. Like we're both very happy in our own company with each other, and not being that sociable. And so I sort of sometimes have that tug of feeling, oh, I wish I was a bit more sociable, but then knowing that I don't really want to be more sociable.
That's not me.
And so I have to sort of tell myself that, like, don't let the thoughts get out of control that you're missing it.
Yep.
You choose this and you're happy doing this. But
and they're not sharing everything. They're not, like, there'll be some of them that wake up at 3 a.m. and they hate, you know, they're hating themselves and they don't share that.
Yeah.
That's like a big thing. Everybody hides behind that stuff.
Well, that's right, isn't it? Like, I, you know, I think I did a post on this at Christmas, actually, just gone, about how people only post the best photos of the night, you know, the early photos really of the night, or the really nicely captured ones of them dancing on the dance floor. Otherwise,
curated
images. Curated. Yeah, the rest of them, like, no one takes the photo at 2 a.m. when people have
Although now, being sober, I go into the toilets if we're out for a night, wherever I go in the toilets, and I'll be like, oh my God, I still look the same. This is great. Like, I still look how I walked in.
Oh, that's so funny. I had that as well. Last year, I think I went to a wedding and I was one of the only ones that wasn't drinking really in the evening, and out of our sort of group of friends. And yeah, there was a few other people that I didn't know that well. And a few people made a comment actually saying, oh my God, you look so fresh, when it was about 10 at night. I was thinking,
because I am.
I feel really good hearing that. Thank you. But no, that is, it's a big surprise, isn't it, to go into the toilets in the evening and think, oh, I literally look the way that I did when I left the house. Because
it took me by surprise.
You can't say that so much when you're a bottle of Prosecco in, can you?
Nope.
So what would be your top three tips for people to get and stay successfully sober?
So number one would be to find community or support. That's the one thing that I really did different this time. I was very open and honest. And the community has been a huge game changer. Like, I've got people, I've never even met these people. I just want to hug them. Everybody's just so lovely. The other one would be to find other things that you like doing that aren't drinking. So replace it. So for me, I obviously do ice skating, but I also love to paint, crochet, you know, go for hikes, cold water swims, crazy stuff like that.
Lovely.
But so replacing it, because you will find joy in those things.
Yeah.
So replacing alcohol with other things. And the other one would be to find out what the work is for you and do the work.
Mm. Yeah, I love that.
And try everything. I've tried everything, I think, until I finally kind of got to this point where I found something for me that is working. I've tried everything, tried it all.
But that's great though, isn't it? I do think you have the time and more energy, to be fair, to throw a lot more at it and to get into some different things and to experiment. So it's kind of win-win, really. I always think that when you're newly sober, you've got the luxury of time, and rather than sitting around feeling, letting yourself get bored or feeling, just use that time to do things, learn things, read things, listen to things, try things.
And even within sobriety, like, so I am now so interested in neuroscience and neurotransmitters, and I've been listening to Andrew Huberman, and like, that stuff blows my mind. So like, learning all that stuff is really interesting. But, and I've heard a lot of people say that, like, in early sobriety they treat it like a job.
Yeah.
So like a career path almost, and they learn everything around it. And I think, I don't know if I did that so much, but I just felt like when I heard that, that's such good advice.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I always say that I've got degree level learning in sobriety. But you know, I was just laser focused on it. You know, I took a lot of joy in learning what I could, and I'm the same as you. The science excites me.
I love it.
And and I was even thinking to myself, because I've been on a bit of a roller coaster with learning, because I found out I'm ADHD and probably autistic, and so you know, this whole thing around special interests and hyper focusing, and now it all makes sense to me, and I think sobriety is like a special interest for me. And so even a year ago I was thinking, could I do a degree in neuroscience? And I've managed to convince myself that I probably won't, because I think you need to be really
good
at maths.
It's crossed my mind.
I wouldn't say maths is my strength, to be honest. It's not like I can't, but you know, I definitely feel very drawn to, I've got tons of books on that kind of stuff, like psychology, neuroscience, and I love it.
Yeah.
It's sort of new passion. I think a lot of people probably do go into, you know, especially that giving back as well. So whether it's going down that more scientific route, or just maybe counselling, therapy, some skills in there, or, you know, coaching, which is what I've done, and or volunteering and just healing and just giving back in general, being here in this podcast,
that's where I like the message groups I've got, because there's often people on there that need, you know, help or support. And again, I still use it for me even, but it's so nice to give back.
It really is. And just remind us, where can we find you on Instagram?
So it's no_more_day1s, and it's day, the number one, and an S, but no more day ones.
So it's at no_more_day1s, but it's day one and then an S. One.
Yes.
Day one. Is it day one, the number, and then an S?
Yeah. That's it. I know, it's a bit confusing.
That's awesome. Oh, thanks, Hannah. It's been so nice to catch up with you today. And I really appreciate you staying up late. What time is it over there?
5 to 10.
Late night. I really appreciate it. Really inspiring story, and huge well done on your 268 days. Thank you so much. And thank you to everybody else. All the best.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.